It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh Public Schools has seen a decline in enrollment this academic year. It comes on the heels of the pandemic, a transportation shortage, and the departure of the district superintendent after an ethics investigation. WESA's education reporter Sarah Schneider joins us. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Sarah, approximately how many students are not attending PPS this year?
So that's a hard question to answer, but we know that enrollment did dip below 20,000 students. And so the reason that I'm not giving a specific number right now is because this number is fluid. Enrollment has to be reported to the state and federal government October 1st enrollment. So students that were there on October 1st. And that gives, you know, the state a good sense of where families are, and that, you know, impacts funding especially. We do think that about 1,900 students are not in Pittsburgh Public anymore. And it's hard to tell where they're going, and the district is trying to figure that out right now, and that's why they've been really hesitant to talk about this. I had to get this data through a right to know request, because even though I got the numbers on October 5th of that enrollment, it's changed since then, almost 100 fewer students since then, and that will change as they continue to contact families and figure out where these students are.
Where are we seeing the biggest drop in enrollment? Is it K through 12, kindergarten, elementary? Where is it?
It's consistent through the grades, but the biggest drop is definitely in kindergarten. Typically, PPS sees about 1,800 kindergartners every year. Last year, there were 1,400, and this year there are about 1,500. So 300 students is a big drop. It's hard to know where they are, and that's what the district keeps saying, that they're concerned about where these kindergartners are. You know, they assume that maybe families are just holding their kids back because they don't have to enroll them right now, and, you know, kids can't be vaccinated, and so for maybe safety concerns during the pandemic, they're keeping them home. We also have seen some growth in charter schools. We've been tracking here at WESA the enrollment at Pittsburgh charter schools, and kindergarten hasn't been a huge jump, though. So we think, you know, families could just be leaving the city or, again, just not enrolling their kids in kindergarten.
Any similarities or differences with other districts, maybe suburban districts?
So I did speak with Mark DiRocco. He's the executive director of the Pennsylvania Association of School Leaders, and he meets with superintendents regularly. And he's hearing anecdotally from these superintendents that their kindergartens are actually growing. And so we're not sure why this is happening, especially in Pittsburgh, but we won't know if this is a trend throughout the state until mid-November when that official data is released.
So still a lot of unknowns, but could it even be a decline in the number of 5- and 6-year-olds actually living in the city?
Yeah, we're not seeing a real birth rate drop. And that is something that I talked to the district about. And they said if we did see that, we would be talking about it. And that's not really where it's happening. And, you know, consistently, we're seeing families leave Pittsburgh altogether. You know, the decline in population in Pittsburgh is evident. And that could be in part driven by choices for education.
Mm-hmm. The decline in the number of kids going to kindergarten, is there a concern that students who don't enroll in kindergarten will never be seen by PPS, even in later grades?
Definitely. I mean, we saw from last year that drop in kindergarten rolled over to first grade. And so it's clear that those families did not come back to Pittsburgh Public for first grade, speaking broadly right now. But that is the concern, that if we're not getting them in kindergarten, then we're going to lose them.
All right. So you have a drop in the number of students across the board, and especially, as you mentioned, in kindergarten. What are the impacts of a declining enrollment?
First, the vitality of a city in many ways is driven by a quality public education system. So thriving cities in this country are often backed by quality equal opportunity systems. So there is a concern that when families choose to leave the system, there's also evidence to show that they're leaving the city entirely. So that's the tax base, right?
Right.
But it also means that the school board's going to have to make some really hard decisions about infrastructure, because the capacity at Pittsburgh Public right now is about 40,000 and enrollment is about half of that. The average age of a Pittsburgh Public building is 85 years. It's aging and it's more expensive as these buildings age to maintain them. So the administration did make a pitch last year to close some schools, and that's likely going to be a conversation during this budget season.
The underused or unused buildings, that's been an ongoing issue, though, for years and years, not just last year and this year.
You know, in the past, there have been moves by Pittsburgh Public of previous administrations to right-size the district. That's what they called it, to realign. And that's something that a lot of people don't want to talk about because it could mean, you know, closing your neighborhood school and then kids will have to be bused across the city. And so it's a really hard conversation to have, but it's becoming more apparent that it's going to happen.
Another impact, basically dollars. Yes, you're mentioning the vitality of a school district, of a city, and you were talking about empty buildings or unused buildings. But what about cash coming from the state?
Yeah, dollars follow a student. And so if a student goes to a charter school, the public school district has to send that money then to the charter school. And the charter schools do have to notify the district when that happens. But whenever a student goes to a private school or just leaves the district doesn't know that. And so they're not going to know how much money they're getting for a while until they contact all of these families and know where these students are, which is another complication because the district is very short-staffed right now. And so school social workers and school counselors are the ones that are contacting these families. And right now, you know, the district has told me those people are often covering classes because they are not substitutes. And so it's going to be a long time before we find out where all of these students are.
Sarah Schneider is WESA's education reporter. Thanks, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin.
In a previously aired version of the Confluence, our guest misspoke and incorrectly referenced the compulsory age for school attendance in Pennsylvania. That error has been removed. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. October 27th, 2018, 11 worshipers were shot and killed inside the Tree of Life Synagogue in Squirrel Hill, the worst hate-fueled anti-Semitic attack in our nation's history. This week, Pittsburgh is hosting the inaugural Eradicate Hate Global Summit at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center. The summit features speakers with expertise from federal anti-terrorism to constitutional law to social media. Laura Ellsworth, partner in charge of global community service initiatives at Jones Day, is one of the co-chairs of the summit. Laura, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us, Kevin.
And Seamus Hughes is the deputy director of the program on extremism at George Washington University and one of the speakers at the summit. Seamus, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Laura, how did the summit come about?
The idea for the summit first arose within days after the killings. And it really came about because I, like so many other people in Pittsburgh, knew and loved people who were there that day. And thought to myself, I want this city to be remembered for how it responded to hate, not how it was victimized by hate. And the idea came to me of bringing together some of the global experts in the anti-hate sphere who are here in Pittsburgh. And how could we bring all of these people together across disciplines, across borders, to make and build the most significant institution in the world to fight hate and extremism.
Seamus, from afar, how do you see how Pittsburgh responded to the hate?
I think Pittsburgh was unique in many ways. And I think, unfortunately, you know, I've been looking at extremism in America for the last 20 years. And I think, unfortunately, people move on too quickly and become numb to the violence and the hatred. And I think Pittsburgh took a different approach, which is enough. And we've got to wrap our head around this problem and try to address it so we don't have another event like that. And so when Laura called me and said, listen, I have this event, I'm thinking about it, are you interested? The answer was immediately yes, because so few cities do that type of after work. It's understandable that people want to take a step back after a mass casualty, a mass murdering event, but very few kind of want to take the next step to try to prevent the next one.
Laura, do you think we want to take a step back, or maybe we even want to forget it because it's so painful?
I think it's incumbent on that, on those of us who were not there that day, to step up and continue the fight in the name of those who were, and who for many good reasons are finding the month of October every single year incredibly difficult to handle. That's why people like Seamus and the other people who are coming to the summit have to step up and lead this fight forward.
This is happening a week before the anniversary of the Tree of Life massacre. How should this conference honor the memory of those who died? Laura?
There will be a number of events through the conference where we talk about the Tree of Life. And one in particular that's being done by Rita Katz near the beginning talks about how the words that were spoken here in Pittsburgh have echoed in acts of violent hate across the world, and how what happened here in Pittsburgh is connected to many events around the world that have happened since. We're also honoring them because the premise by which we invited every single speaker here is that we're coming here in the memory of 11 people who died here. And that requires each one of us to bring the best of what we have to this event to find solutions. And there are many people who are coming to this event who don't agree with one another, who have different viewpoints on this issue. And we're calling them here to find solutions, to suppress their individual issues in the name of finding common solutions in places where they can work together. And to do that because we want to make sure that families like those in Pittsburgh who suffered this terrible loss do not have to suffer a loss like this in the future, because we bring people together, we take active steps to prevent acts of hate before they happen around the world.
Seamus, how important is that to hear differing voices?
Oh, of course. We're in a world right now of polarization, right? Everyone goes to their own sides, their own echo chambers. They don't want to listen to any other views. And so the most important part about this conference is there's going to be a lot of people I disagree with and a lot of people that disagree with me. But the goal is not the differences. The goal is really, what's the solution? Where are the common grounds? And we're not going to solve all the world's problems in a week conference, but we're going to try. And we're at least going to set the stage to have these conversations about the rise of anti-Semitism in this country, the rise of hate crimes in this country, the rise of extremism of all forms in this country. And how do we wrap our head around it? Is the right approach different government authorities? Is it more robust civil society engagement? Is it all those things, or is it none of those things, right?
Laura.
One of the reasons we're doing it in person, and there are about 100 global experts coming from around the world to be in person together, to engage with one another, to really talk about these issues, to build true personal relationships of trust and constructive working together. And as he says, we live in a world where so many people talk at each other or past each other or about each other, but so rarely with each other. As Seamus said, we're talking about all kinds of hate. As we know, what happened to Tree of Life arose from an anti-Semitic animus, anti-immigrant animus. We're going to be talking about those things. We're also going to be talking about anti-Muslim, anti-Black, anti-LGBT, anti-Chinese. There are so many different forms of hate that manifest themselves in the world. They have some commonalities. They have some differences. We're going to be talking about all of that and how we get our arms around all of that together.
Seamus, you're speaking on a panel about visualizing hate, which will use data and expertise to show the breadth of hate throughout the world. Within the U.S., how widespread is the issue of extremism?
So it's widespread, but it's not overwhelming, meaning that we're seeing a number of data points. And the point of the visualization project is to bring data points from dozens of research centers, universities, and think tanks around the world, looking at, say, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, anti-Asian bigotry, bringing that all together and saying, okay, where are we on this? Is the data going up? Is it going down? Is it going flat? Is it going up in certain places? And if it is, how do we focus on it? Is it going up online? Things like that. And there's something to be said about, I'm an academic, but it's also important for the public to see it kind of in a visual way. And so getting away from those 1,000 pages of Excel spreadsheets of, you know, 40,000 kind of data points into something that someone can wrap their head around. And that's really the point of kicking out the conference. So everyone's on the same page of what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Laura?
And what Seamus has led as one of the leaders of the data project, along with David Danks, is the combination of data sets of our speakers that have never before been combined. They lived in silos supporting the independent work of different organizations. And it's an illustration of the power of this summit to bring together global data to see what that big picture tells us when you bring it all together.
Seamus, what are some events that you think maybe shifted our thinking in where our threats lie?
I think there's a kind of a number of events, right? We saw the kind of the rise of white supremacist attacks and militia groups around the country in terms of the last year or so, and a particular rise in the idea of conspiracy theories. So QAnon and things like that, taking a outsized role, not only in the online space, but the offline space too. And so what we basically see is a scattershot of extremism. So it's not just kind of the ISIS and the Al-Qaeda of post 9/11, but also far right, far left, single issue extremism. And so we're seeing obviously a cornucopia of things, which makes the way we address it much harder, right? There are some similarities, but there's a lot of differences. and our legal structures are set up in different ways depending on the threats, our data collection set up in different ways depending on what we're looking at. And so the idea of this conference is to get everybody together so we can at least be talking on the same music sheet.
Do you think that domestic extremism was overlooked here in this country while people focused on threats beyond our shores, such as ISIS?
I mean, there was clearly a rise of domestic extremism in the last 10 to 15 years that has gone relatively unabated. And these individuals have been able to recruit, radicalize, and organize in a way that, say, an individual who would be supporting ISIS would not be able to. And so, yes, I think we've seen a shift of resources. What's interesting now is we're seeing a change in policies towards that. So if it was 90-10 before of looking at ISIS and Al-Qaeda, it's now about 50-50 of how the U.S. government approaches it. In fact, the administration released a new national strategy on domestic terrorism. So we're in the early stages of how this changes kind of the national security approach to it. And that's why a conference like this kind of shape public policy on this, right? Let's actually make an informed decision on whether we put X number of FBI agents on this or Y number of analysts, right?
Laura, outside of the summit, beyond the participants, how do you feel the summit can help combat hate?
Hate is a multifaceted, multidisciplined problem, and it is one whose solution resides in every single one of us, not just the experts, not just the government. For example, community preparedness, community awareness, education of people about hate crimes and what makes people susceptible to the grooming of hate crimes. We have speakers talking about the grooming of teenagers online through video games, where extremist groups will watch the language being used by children playing video games and begin to target those who they think might be ripe to be recruited into extremist movements. So there are so many people who have to be part of the solution, but I do agree with what Seamus says, that bringing together people, coming up with specific concrete plans that you then can act on and come together a year from now at the summit and identify, did you accomplish what you set out to do in the year? Did you not? Where are you? It is the opening chapter of what we hope will be here decades to come, where global experts gather together, working groups emanate from the summit to do specific tasks, the results of which will be reported on at the next year's summit. And by that process, we will move the needle forward. And I wish I could tell you that it'll take 5 years and we'll be done. But hate has been here for millennia. It is not something that will be solved in my lifetime or Seamus's or yours, but it is something that we can move the needle on, all of us, each of us.
We tend to rely on our elected leaders, our policymakers, our experts like yourselves, but what role do everyday citizens play here?
There's a variety of different roles everyday citizens can play. In fact, when you look at hate crimes that have occurred or violent kind of terrorist attacks, there's usually a bystander effect, right? Somebody saw something on the lead up to that point, but didn't really know what they saw or couldn't wrap their head around it or didn't know the tools they had available. Like, who do you talk to about addressing this? And so getting that information out to the public at large, I think it's quite important. There's also some level of understanding about, let's say, look at an issue of like online radicalization. To know that your mother, your sister, your brother is going down a rabbit hole and to realize that rabbit hole is happening and to look and figure out what tools and what NGOs or civil society is available to talk it through is vitally important.
Laura?
It is, as our good fellow steering committee member, Jerry Cohen, says, this is the translational medicine of the hate field. How do we take what's going on in academia based on data and deliver it to communities so they can make use of it? Get communities to know one another. How can they know their Jewish brothers and sisters, their Asian brothers and sisters, their Muslim brothers and sisters? Because it's much harder to hate that which you know well.
Eradicating hate. How much of it is responding to a hateful incident compared to being proactive, the education to slow the spread of hate?
Prevention is what we're really focused on, to make sure that that person doesn't walk into that synagogue and shoot those people. And how can we identify when somebody is approaching the line of actual overt action, and how do we intersect? That being said, that person would never have approached that line without a lot of lead up to it that we can get at through these other educational systems.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. I tend to veer towards the proactive version as opposed to reactive. I think reactive is good to learn lessons about where there was mistakes made and how you can adjust your law enforcement approach, your civil society approach on those things. But at the end of the day, it doesn't solve the problem. And so that's where you need to lean on the kind of proactive engagement.
Laura has said earlier that hate's been around for millennia. So the problem of extremism and hate seems so big. Do you think it's insurmountable? And Seamus, we'll start with you.
So I'm a forever optimist. It could just be my Irish nature, right? You're never going to be able to get rid of everything. The hope is to make a little bit of a difference in the world, right? And this is kind of why I got into this type of research. I didn't just want to stare at the problem. I just didn't want to just feel bad all the time about all the horrible things I saw. I wanted to actually affect change on it.
I think if you look at how Pittsburgh responded after 1027, your answer lies there. And we saw people in Pittsburgh of all faiths, all walks of life, all different backgrounds coming together and standing in solidarity. And what we want to do is we want to take all of those people who are standing in solidarity and we want to activate them. We want to give them actual things that they can do that we know make a difference in the fight against hate. And nothing is insurmountable. And if on that pathway to the fight, we save one family, two families, 10 families, it will all have been worth it.
Laura Ellsworth is the partner in charge of Global Community Service Initiatives at Jones Day and is one of the co-chairs of the Eradicate Hate Global Summit at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center this week. And Seamus Hughes is deputy director of the program on extremism at George Washington University and one of the speakers at the summit. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
Thanks for having us.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Rebecca Reese, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.